Hi, my name is Jesse Hirsch, and this is The Future Herd, a podcast about collaboration and leadership for a changing food system. Today's conversation was with Renee Van Acker, President and Vice Chancellor of the University of Guelph, an institution that has shaped Canadian agriculture for generations. What makes this dialogue compelling is not just his position, but his clarity about the responsibilities that universities, researchers, and leaders now carry as the sector confronts uncertainty, volatility, and rapid technological change. We explore how academic cultures rooted in agriculture and veterinary service are evolving into platforms for cross-sector collaboration, why extension and public engagement remain essential, and how students are emerging as one of the most powerful engines of innovation. Renee speaks candidly about the need to create open space for new futures, spaces where interdisciplinary entrepreneurialism and long-term thinking can displace the short-termism that dominates our politics and media. It's a conversation about institutional leadership, generational momentum, and the kind of imagination required to build the food system we actually need. I'm having everyone start by just stating your name, organizational affiliation, and why you think the future is important.
My name is Renee Van Acker, and I'm President and Vice Chancellor of the University of Guelph. And the future is important because we all depend upon it.
Now, one of the big buzzwords or themes of the Agra 2050 event was collaboration. And it strikes me that both when we talk about collaborative futures, but also when we talk about a long-term foresight process, collaboration is kind of the prerequisite. It's the through line. What does collaboration look like for you? What role do you think the academy or researchers play in facilitating that kind of collaboration?
Yeah, it's absolutely important. And when I think about, let's say, faculty here at the University of Guelph, we have a culture here in terms of our approach to academia, which is really born out of our heritage, which is as an agricultural school, as a veterinary college. And there's a practicality and a pragmatism to it. There's also a desire amongst our faculty, by and large, to want to see knowledge in action. And so in that vein, they typically are looking at interacting with either industry or community organizations, NGOs, so that they can be doing work in the real world or with real world problems. And so that is, of its very nature, a collaboration. In addition, our faculty are always keen to have student training somehow embedded in everything they do. And so especially with, say, thesis-based graduate students, that is also a collaboration. And so I think it's a natural for us. But that's some of how I reflect on that question.
Well, and let me double down on that, because I think one of the assets or one of the advantages that researchers can bring to practitioners and industry is a long-term perspective. That I think there is a tendency, you know, farmers do tend to be the exception to this rule in terms of my joke of farmers being futurists, but industry generally tends to be pragmatic, tends to be practical, tends to focus on fast returns. What role can researchers and academics play in fostering a sense of the future, a concern for the future, and an eye on the long term?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that is a luxury of their position, but also a responsibility they have, because they have the luxury of that in their positions. And you're right. You know, the ideal faculty member for us is someone who is deeply rooted in their discipline, has a deep academic interest, and wants to do practical work with community organizations or industry. But on the former, they have that privilege and responsibility to be able to think longer into the future, to consider longer term implications, In agriculture, for example, we have many faculty who are very interested in and working on soil health. And, you know, soil health it can be a very long-term effort. And if you're, let's say you're renting farmland, soil health may not be your first priority, especially if it's an ephemeral rent. And but faculty members can, for example, think about that as a very long-term need and bring their capacity to bear on it.
Right on. And speaking of capacity, what are the kind of social or provincial factors that could make research more accessible, that could enable the capacity and capabilities that the University of Guelph, that researchers and faculty offer, so that industry and farmers, you know, not even know it's there, but are able to leverage it at a scale that we aspire to, but perhaps are not there yet?
We're very lucky here at the University of Guelph that we have a long-standing partnership with the Ontario Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Agribusiness, and we have this alliance agreement, which is in part a funding agreement, and that that supports for us a broader range of expertise than we would have if we were running our agriculture and veterinary colleges only on a university model, which is an education revenue model. And so that's good in terms of having a capacity across the range in agriculture. And our faculty are very interested, as I said, in getting research into practice. And so many of our faculty are still engaged in what I would call extension, sometimes called knowledge translation transfer, knowledge mobilization, but let's call it extension. And that's really important. One, for engagement, community building, for mutual understanding, but also to bring awareness of new knowledge, understanding of issues, et cetera, new practices, whatnot, directly to farmers, to industry folks, to community people, to NGOs. So that's a really important activity. We acknowledge it and encourage it amongst our faculty, and that's not necessarily typical. It is a challenge because, you know, the bulk of the university's budget is an education revenue model. And so there isn't necessarily funding for extension like there is in the US with the land-grant universities. But nonetheless, culturally, it's part of who we are and what we do. And our faculty find it a very important activity. Not only do they find it important, they feel that it's a responsibility. It's something so many of them enjoy doing. And it also enhances then their world, their understanding of what they do, contextualizes the work they do, and it often leads them to understand new problems that they need to be working on.
Well, and certainly in my lifetime, I think extension within the university has gone from something that was kind of neglected to something that's being now championed as one of the kind of pillars of post-secondary education. But with that said, what are some of the remaining obstacles? You sort of alluded to funding as being one of them, but what are the obstacles to extension? What are the things that we should be looking at that we should be removing or rethinking to enable even greater extension across all of society?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, certainly for us, funding is a concern because we want to maintain that capacity, because the capacity is then the possibility of extension. But yeah, what are other obstacles? You know, I think I feel very optimistic, and I tremendously enjoyed your presentation at the Adaptation Council, your keynote. It was inspiring, and it was a reminder to all of us in the room that technology has always been there. There's always been new technology, and so it's so key how you view it. how you take it on board, and whether you have a positive view or a negative view, but taking a positive view is possibilities. And with extension, for example, you know, all of the advances in data technology, media technology, are opportunities for making breakthroughs in terms of extension, podcasts or things like this, using social media, and. We see that many in the agricultural sector are doing that, right? They're creating their own avenues and platforms for conversation and for extension. And so you know, that starts to remove barriers. Right off the top of this, you talked about bandwidth, and certainly bandwidth, an ability for everybody to have the technical capacity, which primarily is driven by bandwidth, is also really, really important. So much of agriculture is always going to continue to be so much of it happening outside and in so many places, and often in places where there's not a lot of population. And so having really reliable and quality Wi-Fi is something that is so necessary if we're all going to be able to take advantage of technology.
Well, and relatedly, let me ask you a question, both in terms of your hat as president, but also your hat as a researcher. You know, one of the things I was really impressed with the folks from the University of Guelph who were at the event was how interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary a lot of the research is. Can you talk about it, not just in the context of research, but in the context of cross-sectoral collaboration? How important is it that we foster the kind of interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary communication, collaboration, exchange? And I bring this up because it strikes me that's part of the extension piece, right, is getting people out of silos and getting people cross-pollinating, as it were, to milk the metaphor.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's one of the reasons I'm a proponent of and am pushing for more entrepreneurialism in agriculture and food. And one of the reasons I'm interested in that is that it has a possibility of bringing new communities, new perspectives into agriculture and food. And that includes new technologies, which are then driven by different or new disciplines, you know, disciplines that may not be traditional disciplines in the agriculture and food space. And then that in turn leads to interdisciplinarity, collaboration, back to the first theme. So yeah, I'm really keen on that. And that's a this and that approach. So it's the this being maybe a much more traditional innovation approach in agriculture, which is a kind of a for the commons approach driven by public institutions, maybe collaboration with multinationals, but in more traditional discipline areas, as opposed to, or in addition, entrepreneurship approach, which tends to be very much bubbling up from the grassroots and widely distributed, and an opportunity to bring in unexpected or non-traditional technologies and perspectives on those technologies. That's an exciting frontier, super exciting.
I agree wholeheartedly. And one of the words that for me is often adjacent to entrepreneurialism is leadership. And, you know, that was, I think, another kind of a theme of the event. Where do you see that leadership coming from? And what role do you think that academics have to play or could play in facilitating that excitement, in facilitating these kinds of collaborations across sectors, but to your point, also across cultures, because asking academics to be entrepreneurs is asking them to essentially embrace a new culture, which I agree is exciting, but where's the leadership piece in all that? Because these are kind of new trails that we're asking people to blaze.
It's a great question, and you're right. You know, especially when, you know, we're not hiring necessarily for faculty members who have an entrepreneurial bend. That's not our typical hiring process, although we should be thinking about that. When I think of entrepreneurialism, I have to admit, tend to think more about students. And there's a greater possibility just numbers-wise, because it's a much bigger pool, and it's also a constantly renewing pool of people. So it's a tremendous opportunity for any and all universities in that regard. But in terms of leadership, myself, for example, part of my responsibility is to listen to people like you and to get excited and to maybe expand my thinking, and then in turn translate that into what should I be doing as a leader for the University of Guelph, for example, to listen and hear what you're saying and think about what that means for us as an institution and our responsibility to create the future. How do we do that? It's exceedingly difficult to do And I said it at the conference where, you know, the default for most people is we take our past and we chuck it in front of us and that's our future. So there is no new future really. And we have a responsibility to try to create open space in front of us. Listening to somebody like you, for me, creates open space. I'm like, oh yeah, I've never thought about that. And that's a completely, and then when somebody like you presents it with such tremendous enthusiasm, you know, you had an analogy of preaching being like a sermon, and yes, 100%. And like a sermon, it's meant to be inspirational, right? So I want to thank you for that. But in turn, then, in my own role and all the people in that room, hopefully they are also taking that on board in terms of their responsibility as leadership. So then translate that and then to think, okay, what does that mean for action in my institution? So that I am taking steps to, as a leader, to make sure that we are doing things to help create truly a new future. So entrepreneurialism, for example, is one of those things. And we really pushed here at the University of Guelph to be part of a Lab to Market program, which the federal government stood up last year. And thankfully, we have some leaders here like Evan Fraser, who scrambled and put together that application, and with folks from across the country to create a national innovation platform that's really focused on early stage entrepreneurialism, specifically to agriculture and food. So that's taking visions of the future and then translating it into action for an institution and the sector. You know, that's how I see my leadership role. And
right on. And I appreciated your points about kind of creating spaces in which our minds can expand or our perceptions of the future can be shaken up. And I mean, to be fully disclosive, my source of inspiration in many of those situations are young people. That the benefit of the technology and media world we live in now is it makes it really easy for me to connect and learn from some of the young entrepreneurs who are changing our world. I'm curious to bring it back to students. You know, how are you seeing their attention span, for lack of a better contentious phrase, and their perception of their role in society? Because I agree, the entrepreneurial piece is where a lot of students really find their purpose or find their opportunity. But what more can we be doing to foster leadership amongst young people, to foster confidence amongst young people, and give them a sense not only that there's a place for them in our society, but to your point, that there's an open place, that they can change our perceptions of the future, and we want them to change our perceptions of the future?
Yes, certainly a university has a deep responsibility in that respect. I have to say, I feel, you know, when people ask me about the next generations, I feel perennially optimistic. And I've had the pleasure of teaching, you know, my whole career. And I find that inspirational. And the reason I find it inspirational is that despite everything that's going on, and, you know, there is a lot of popular fretting about the next generations and are they inspired and are they just playing video games or whatever it might be. I don't see that. I see young people who are excited about the future. I see young people who are passionate about issues. I see young people who embrace technology and live and breathe it and then see possibilities in it that I could never see, because I don't live in their world. That's inspiring. That's absolutely inspiring. So one of our responsibilities is to continue to be a place where students can come to, you know, we are on a growth trajectory right now as a university. And part of the reason for that is that we have a demand for students to come to the University of Guelph that's above the sector average. And so we feel a responsibility to open our doors to bring in as many as possible. Is it kind of, are we a little bit bursting at the seams? Yes, we kind of are. Am I happy about that? Yeah, I am kind of happy about that. And I have to say, we were a little bit worried about what our staff and faculty would think about that. And actually, we're not hearing complaints. I mean, our staff and faculty seem to be embracing it, and which I'm super thankful for. But it's exciting, you know. We feel that excitement, and we feel possibilities for the future in that way. So I'm optimistic in the interactions I have with our students, and they have so many advantages over us. One is, you know, as opposed to somebody like me in my age, they don't have so much future to chuck in front of them, and so they do have more open space in front of them, and many of them take advantage of that, which is great to see. So thankful for that.
Well, and I agree wholeheartedly. I feel that there is a tremendous amount of excitement and optimism to be found when looking at younger generations. And in particular, I think what you articulated, their demand for knowledge is insatiable. And that is something that we can be leveraging and facilitating. So I agree with you, better to deal with overcrowding than to deal with the opposite. But the one thing, and here I'm leading up, this is kind of a final question, and this is the real hardball pitch. One of the things that young people, I think, do have, unfortunately, is a lot of anxiety around climate change. And one of the things I was kind of disappointed at the event was we didn't talk enough about the future and climate change. And just this week, the President of the United States at the United Nations General Assembly implored countries around the world to see climate change as a hoax, that it's a trap, that they're losers to believe in it. So with that very contentious intro aside, what role do you think climate change plays in our future, both when it comes to encouraging collaboration, but also when it comes to intergenerational collaboration? Because this does seem to be something that young people are very passionate about and want to do something about, given that they're the ones most likely to face the consequences. So I'm curious, what role do you think that climate change as a theme kind of plays in us wrapping our heads around Ontario's food future?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you're right, Jesse. It didn't feature as an issue at the Adaptation Council conference. I mean, I think that conference needed to be multiple days. But
agreed.
And there are next steps. You know, our students and our faculty have not forgotten about climate change. And I can tell you that it does feature in conversations, it does feature in classrooms, it does feature in research projects, and maybe in particular in agriculture and food. I think if President Trump asked the farmers of America about climate change, he might be surprised at the answer he gets, because we know that farmers around the world, regardless of political stripe, are very worried about climate change, because the vast majority of agriculture happens outside and is subject to weather. And farmers understand, especially older farmers, that the climate is changing. And they are noticing more dramatic weather events. They're noticing the amplitude around the mean is increasing. And they and we understand that our greatest challenge is unpredictability of weather, and also that amplitude around the mean. So, you know, very hot, very dry, very cold, very wet, all of those sorts of things are really hard to manage. You know, if climate change was just a matter of the average changing and the amplitude, you know, was small, I think our ability to adapt would be much greater, and we might be a little bit less worried. Might be. But that's not how it is. I mean, climate change starts to create chaos, and farmers can't deal with chaos in our climate. And so it is a real issue for us. And farmers, regardless of political stripe, there's something that they will always talk about, and that's the weather. And they know, because many of them are observers for decades and decades, they know that this ain't normal, and it's a problem. Our students as well, who are always attuned to issues, one of the issues that they continue to be attuned to, regardless of the political rhetoric or what's going on, is climate change.
That's very encouraging, especially your point about farmers. And it does suggest that we need to be having the kind of foresight conversations and the foresight collaborations that deal with those amplitudes, that deal with those big swings, because I think conceptually, that's what a lot of people are not understanding. They're sort of thinking, oh, global warming, things are going to get warmer. They're not thinking climate volatility and the way in which things are going to get really quite uncertain. So I guess as a second last question, how do we bake that in? How do we foster that literacy so that our foresight exercises are informed and prepare us for the big swings that inevitably we're all going to be facing?
I think you said it at the beginning about short-term thinking versus long-term thinking. And something I was hoping for the conference and worried about was whether the conference would be very much about, you know, what's right here in front of our faces versus, you know, what's out 5, 10, 30 years from now. And thankfully, I think the conference was successful in keeping people looking out over the horizon. We need more of that. We need more of that. You know, the media, the way it's constructed now, politics, the way it's constructed now, is all about what's happening this minute, as opposed to what's happening in the next year, what's happening in the next 10 years, what's happening in the next 50 years. And I think there's another opportunity for leadership. I'm grateful to the Adaptation Council that they're taking us on. I have a sense that they're going to continue this conversation about looking out over the horizon and thinking about implications in that time scale for us. That's really, really important, because so much of our society is the opposite. I say, you know, we're being subjected to populist politics of inches as opposed to nation building for decades or centuries.
Right on. And any final thoughts or visions for this process and the future?
You know, I want to come back to you, Jesse, and really what a revelation it was seeing you at that conference and listening to your keynote and being inspired by your keynote. Your ability to intersect, to, you know, you are somebody who watches and looks out over the horizon and thinks about how pieces are coming together and how that fits. We need more of you, more of that for us to help us to see what's happening, to create awareness for us in terms of what's happening, to put it in the context of the future and maybe out over the horizon, and especially your ability to intersect the living world, whether that's the environment or people or animals, with the technology world and how those things intersect and what the implications are or the possibilities are in that respect. That is vitally important, and we don't have enough of that. We don't have enough of that. And so it denies us possibilities of seeing opportunities in the future in those intersections. So I would just encourage that. And I'm thankful that you exist, and I'm grateful to have seen you now and know you.
If there was video available now, you'd see that I'm blushing. That, of course, was my conversation with René Van Acker. And what stays with me is his insistence that institutions must do more than manage the present. They have to cultivate the conditions for entirely new futures to take root. His reflections on collaboration, interdisciplinarity, and the role of students point toward a food system where knowledge is not confined to silos, but moves freely across sectors, communities, and generations. If this podcast has a purpose, it's to surface conversations like this, conversations that challenge our assumptions about leadership and invite us to think beyond the narrow timelines imposed by politics and crisis. Thank you for listening and for being part of a wider effort to imagine and build a more resilient and collaborative agri-food future. I'm Jesse Hirsch, and this is The Future Heard. We'll see you next time.